Cap. We were talking there last night about how in 1917 you have what is known as the Balfour Declaration, also known as the British Mandate. And one of the things that the League of Nations at the time had told Great Britain, when Great Britain defeated the Ottoman Empire, is these three things that they were supposed to do. Number one, they were to facilitate Jewish immigration. Number two, they were supposed to encourage close settlement by Jews on the land. And then number three, they were to facilitate the acquisition of Palestinian citizenship by Jews. Before 1967, that term Palestinian referred to Jews. In fact, it wasn't until around 1967 that the Arabs then decided to use the term Palestinian. Before this time, the Palestinians, or the Arabs, said that the term Palestinian was a term that was created by the Zionists, and that they rejected that term because they felt that they themselves were Syrians. It wasn't until after 1967 that they started adopting the term Palestinian. Does anybody know one of the reasons why they adopted that term? Okay. Remember we said that in 1948, when Israel became a nation, within 8 hours, five Arab countries attacked Israel. Well, what they did is when these five Arab countries came in to attack Israel, the Arabs from these lands, these five Arab countries, came in and told the Arabs who were living in the land of Israel, get out. You're in the way. We're going to come in. We're going to destroy Israel. We're going to push Israel into the sea. And you are in the way. So leave. When we destroy Israel, you can come back to your homes. Well, a lot of the Arabs left. In fact, there was around 630,000 Arabs that was living in the land at the time that left their homes. A lot of them didn't take anything with them. They just got up and left. What happened, obviously, is that Israel defeated them. This created a real problem, because these five Arab nations did not want to absorb these 630 Arab refugees. Now, they had made them refugees themselves, but they did not want to absorb them. In other words, like for instance, Jordan. Jordan said, no, we don't want you. Some of the other countries said, no, we don't want you. Why did they say they didn't want them to come into their country? They were afraid that if they came into, let's say, Jordan, that they would come in, they would assimilate into the Jordanian economy, the Jordanian culture, and they would not want to go back to their homeland. And so these 630,000 who were kicked out then became, quote, the Palestinians. So when you hear that term Palestinians, you're talking about the 630,000 Arabs who have been displaced. Now, there was a lot of the Arabs that did not leave the land of Israel. In fact, they said that the Jews treated them better than their Arab brothers did. And they actually became Israeli citizens. And so, but this is where we get a lot of these terms. Well, what happened here in 1917? These were the things that Great Britain was supposed to do. Everything's good, right? They were supposed to, what? Encourage immigration and to facilitate the bringing in the Jews from the other countries. Well, at first it worked all right until the Arabs started complaining. And when the Arabs started complaining, they actually put a hold on the number of Jews that were allowed to come into Israel. And as I said, they did not put any limitations on the number of Arabs that came into the land. Okay, let's move on to our next one real quick. We said that back in around 1922, 1923, things change. They take 78% of the land that was given to Israel, and they used it to create Jordan. And only 1% was given to the French mandate for Syria. So they give up a total of 78%. All right, let's see. Move to the next one. During the 20s and 30s, there was a lot of fighting between the Jews and the Arabs concerning the land. Both sides had been promised the land by Great Britain, and both sides wanted the land. Great Britain was trying to come up with a solution, and every solution they came up with, the Arabs rejected. Well, in April of 1947, Great Britain came to the United Nations and said, "Look, we cannot find a solution to this, so you need to find a permanent solution. You need to form a committee and find a portable a solution to the problem." In November of 1947, the United Nations formed a committee to find a more permanent solution. And this is one of their resolutions. All the area that you see in the orange color, that was to be to go to the Arabs. And what you see there in the greenish color, that was to go to the Jews. By the way, if that roadmap to peace goes through, it's going to look very much like this. Very close to this. You notice that it literally cut Israel in half. Well, if you look, and I don't have a pointer here, but if you can look in the middle of that orange part, you see a white section, or one section that's kind of discolored. That is Jerusalem. Jerusalem was to belong to no one. Jerusalem was to be the property of the United Nations. The reason it was to be part of the United Nations was because the United Nations felt that Jerusalem was the home of the three major religions of the world: Christianity, Judaism, and of course, Islam. Because of that, they didn't feel that any one nation should control it, that it should be controlled by all of them. This is why today, if you come to Jerusalem, you will find that we have a lot of UN vehicles, a lot of United Nations buildings. Now, in Israel, we do not call it the United Nations. For us, UN means United Nothing, or the United Nothingness, because that's what they are, a United Nothing. Now, we kind of laugh about it, because in Jerusalem, on the Mount of Olives, you know, the Mount of Olives is not just one hill, it is a series of mounts. On the northern part of the Mount of Olives, you have Mount Scopus. The center section is the section that everybody is familiar with. That's right across from the Temple Mount. This is where the ancient cemeteries are located. And the southern part of the Mount of Olives, during the time of King Solomon, was known as the Hill of Offense, because this is where Solomon built all of his pagan temples for all of his pagan wives. Well, today, the main United Nations building sits on the Hill of Offense, which we feel is an appropriate place for it, because it is an offense to everyone else. But this is the plan. Notice that the Jews accepted this plan. However, you'll notice that the Arab leaders rejected this plan. They rejected to compromise and launch a military invasion to prevent establishment of a Jewish state within any borders. If you go and look at all the different UN resolutions, you will find that the Arabs always reject it. Why? Does anybody know why? Why would the Arabs want to reject this plan here? Exactly. In order for them to accept this, that means they have to recognize Israel's right to exist. and they are not willing to recognize Israel's right to exist, even if it was only 5 square kilometers. They would not recognize its existence. So this is why you will find that Arafat would never accept any of the conditions, because to do so would be to recognize Israel's sovereignty and Israel's right to exist. This is why we say that there will not be peace between the two peoples. It will not happen. All right, let's move on to our next slide, please. Again, we have the Arab states' wars against Israel. We find the change to the territorial boundaries. You notice in the picture to the left, you see what the boundaries were before 1967. You see that area that they call that other term? We call it Judea and Samaria. They call it the West Bank. The reason it's called the West Bank is because it is on the west side of the Jordan River. It was annexed by Jordan. If you notice what happened in 1967, you notice how Israel has changed. The boundaries have changed. In 1967, on the Six-Day War, again, Israel was attacked. It was unprovoked. Arabs attacked the Jewish people. And this one was tough. This one was very tough because they attacked Israel from every direction. Now, there were some miraculous things that took place during this war of 67, as well as some just very good logic. One of the things that happened was that Israel took out the Egyptian Air Force in one strike. Anybody remember the story? Anybody know how this was accomplished? Israel came flying over the Egyptian air base at top speed, very low to the ground, and flew over the Egyptian air base. But you can imagine flying real low at top speed, what kind of ruckus this is going to cause. It ticked the Egyptians off royally. They jump into their aircraft to go chase the Israelis. By the time the soldiers could get into their planes and take off and fly after Israel, Israel was long gone. The Egyptians flew around for a while, could not find Israel. They came back to their air base. Israel waited to give them enough time for their pilots to get out of their plane and get back into the barracks. About the time that they get back into the barracks, Israel comes back again. Except this time with heat-seeking missiles. The Egyptian aircraft is nice and warm. And of course, when they fired the heat-seeking missiles, it totally wiped out the Egyptian Air Force with one strike. No casualties from the Israelis. There was also another man. Shares the same last name as myself. His name was Eli Cohen. There's a book that was written about him called Our Man from Damascus. Eli Cohen was a double agent between Israel and Syria. The Syrians were having a hard time hiding their bunkers from the Israelis. So Eli convinced the Syrians to plant groves of eucalyptus trees around their bunkers and convince them that this would keep the Israelis from being able to find them. The Syrians were not the sharpest tools in the shed. They did it. Eli went back to the Israelis and said, "Oh, by the way, when you fly over and you see the groves of eucalyptus trees, bomb it. That's where the bunkers are." When I excavated Bethsaida before 1967 was Syria, was part of Syria. When we started excavating at Bethsaida, we found all these Syrian bunkers. right in the middle are the eucalyptus trees. And of course, they had been bombed. So we found that the reports of what Ellie said were in fact accurate. What happened in 67, Israel was victorious. And this time they get all of what we call Israel, as well as the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Sinai Peninsula. Immediately after this war, immediately after they captured, you notice that it says that Israel immediately offered to trade the land for peace. However, the Arabs rejected the offer. Israel at this point made a major faux pas. In fact, it was probably the biggest faux pas in our history. In 1967, we regained control of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. We had a man by the name of Moshe Dayan. Moshe was not a religious Jew. And after we captured Jerusalem and the Temple Mount, Rabbi Goren, which was the chief rabbi for the Israeli Defense Force, the Israeli army, actually started having services up on the Temple Mount. They wanted to build a synagogue up there. They started having prayer meetings up there. They wanted to build a yeshiva up there. And they would start discussing, what do we need to do with the Dome of the Rock? Well, every time the discussion would come up of what should we do with the Dome of the Rock, Rabbi Goren would say, I've got a solution. Blow it up. And Moshe Dayan would say, shut up. They'd have a meeting again, and somebody would say, well, what are we going to do about the Dome of the Rock? Rabbi Goren would say, blow it up. Moshe would say, keep your mouth shut. Again, they would have a meeting. They would start asking. Again, they would start talking. They would start talking and ask, well, what are we going to do with the Dome of the Rock? And again, what would Rabbi Goren say? Blow it up. Except this time, Moshe said, if you open your mouth one more time, I will personally throw you in prison. 1 month later, Moshe Dayan gives back the Temple Mount. There are four reasons why Moshe gave it up. Number one, Israel is still in its embryonic state. They realize that Israel cannot defend itself against all the Arab nations. At this point, there are 22 Arab nations. They realized that if they tried to flex their muscles, that they would be attacked not by five Arab nations, but by 22 Arab nations. And they realized that they did not have the army to be able to go up against 22 nations. He also realized that Israel was still very much in need of help from the international community. He was afraid that if they flexed their muscles, that not only would they have to deal with the 22 Arab nations, they would also have to deal with all the other nations. In other words, we can't go up against the whole world. Moshe was not a religious man. He did not believe in the covenant that God made with our forefather Abraham. He did not think that the Temple Mount had anything to do with Israel's future. And he did not believe that this one piece of land was worth the destruction of the entire nation of Israel. And the last point, he wanted to show the rest of the world that Israel was different from the other countries. every nation who ever conquered Israel made it so that the Jewish people could not come to Jerusalem. And they said that even though we disagree with the Muslims theologically, they said it is, after all, a holy place to them. It's a holy place to the Christians, a holy place to the Jews. So they wanted to be different from all the other nations and say that anybody can come and worship at the Temple Mount. The Muslims, however, rejected that idea. They said, no, no one except Muslims can come to the area. So these are the four reasons that Moshe Dayan gave it up. He believed that if he gave the Temple Mount back to the Muslims, that the Arabs would call him to the peace table in 1 hour. Instead of the Arabs seeing this as an act of good faith and goodwill, the Arabs saw this as a sign of weakness. And instead of stopping the terrorism, it caused it to escalate. Many of us wonder, what would have happened if we had stood our ground and we had said, no, we are going to keep the Temple Mount? I have no doubt that that Israel would have been attacked by the other Arab nations. But I wonder if we robbed God of the opportunity for Him to demonstrate His power in this situation. Yeah, he did it in 1948. It was a miracle that Israel was able to defeat five Arab nations in 1948 with nothing more than a bunch of mortars. We had no aircraft. We had no heavy artillery. God very much was behind it. But all the times in which we were in exile, whenever we came back to Israel, we wanted to rebuild the temple. There were two times in which we did not do that. The first one was the Babylonian captivity. After we came back from the Babylonian captivity, there was only a small number of Jews who actually came back to Jerusalem. Ezra and Nehemiah chastised us for not doing so. In 1948, when Israel became a nation again, there was no desire whatsoever to rebuild the temple. We believe that we were a civilized people, and to go back to such a barbaric practice, we didn't think was right. So there was no desire to do it in 1948. We turned our back on it. In 1967, we captured it and then gave it back. Many Jews feel that the war of 1973, the Yom Kippur War, was judgment on Israel for not doing it. Because we were attacked again, except this time we were attacked on the Day of Atonement, one of the most holy days of the year. But you know what? They forgot something. They attacked us on Yom Kippur because they knew we would not fight on the Day of Atonement. They forgot one thing. Sundown. Come sundown, it's not Yom Kippur anymore. And Israel came back with a vengeance. But it did change. It did cause a lot of changes. From that point on, now when you serve in the military, if you're serving your 30, 45 days per year, you carry your weapon wherever you go. If you get on an Israeli bus, you carry your weapon. Why? This way, if they decide to do something, we don't have to worry about being deployed. We don't have to go back to the barracks and get everything. We are ready. We're packed. We are armed. lock and load. We're ready. So it did bring about some good changes. Okay, what happened in 1973? After the war of 73, Israel was asked to give up one-third of the Sinai Peninsula that they captured. Why? To bring about peace. Right? 1979, Israel was asked to give up another one-third of the area that they captured in 67. Why? To bring about peace, of course. In 1982, we gave up the rest of the Sinai. For what purpose? Peace, of course. Did it ever bring about peace? No. No. In fact, I can remember in Israel when Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated. Before Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, we had T-shirts in Israel that had a picture of Yitzhak Rabin and a Native American chief looking at each other. And it shows Yitzhak Rabin are talking to the Native American chief, and the Native American chief is making a comment to Yitzhak Rabin, and the comment, the caption underneath the Native American's picture was, "Let me tell you about giving away land for peace." All right, let's move on. Go to our next slide. We'll pause for station identification. Actually, if Pastor, if you want to move us down to where next one more Unamas. Okay, go ahead and go another one. All right, let's go. Let's stop right there. And can we go to slideshow and then current slide, please? All right, we notice that pre-World War I, the land of Israel, we said that most of it was either desert or swamps, malaria-infested swamps. Israel actually started bringing in eucalyptus trees to dry up these swamps and to make it good farmland. They also, back in the 1960s, created drip irrigation. Today, Israel is one of the leaders in agriculture. In fact, all the countries around the world, including the United States, come to Israel to learn about its agriculture. One of the things that, the reason that the Arabs wanted Gaza, is in Gaza we had 980 acres of hydroponic greenhouse. We were raising bug-free crops, and it was hydroponic. So it didn't matter where it was, whether it was in the middle of the desert or what. Well, they wanted it. And they thought, oh, great! Unfortunately, they destroyed a lot of them. And what they didn't destroy, the greenhouses would not produce. They actually went back to the UN and asked the UN if they could get the Jews who were running the greenhouses, if they could hire them to come back and run it, because they said it won't work with us. By the way, after the greenhouses were destroyed, the United States gave them $14 million to rebuild it. There was one organization, one foundation, in fact, one family, that gave $10 million of the $14 million to rebuild it. Anybody know who they were? Bill Gates. Bill Gates Foundation. Okay, can we move to our next slide here? Okay, when the Jews first started coming into the land of Israel, many of these Jews came in penniless. And they actually started working the land. Now, a lot of the land that they got, they actually wound up buying from the Arabs at extravagant costs. In fact, about 94% of the land that they bought, they actually bought from absentee Arab landlords. Well, they paid exorbitant prices for the land. So they cleared the wastelands, malaria swamps, and reforested the hillsides. And of course, these were the pioneer Zionists who came in. All right, let's move on to our next one, please. Okay, this is Tel Aviv. In 1909, you notice that Tel Aviv at this point was nothing more than sand dunes. In fact, most of the area on the Mediterranean side was nothing but sand dunes. The Gaza Strip was sand dunes. In fact, when the Jewish people started coming into these areas, everybody laughed at them and said, "Why? Why are you coming here? You can't grow anything here. The land will not do anything. You're crazy. Why do you want this?" Well, let's look at what happened in just a few short years. This is Tel Aviv, now in 1930. You see a difference? From 1909 to 1930, look at the difference. Remember all those sand dunes? Now you have trees. You have buildings. In fact, today, Tel Aviv is one of the most metropolitan areas. Tel Aviv is the New York of Israel. All right, let's move on. Here you have some of the first Jews that came into the area back in 1882. But if you look at them, they almost look like they're Arabs. Notice they're wearing the Arab headdress. You notice everybody has a head covering. It's because in Israel, the sun is shining almost directly on top of you. If you do not have some type of head covering there, you will dehydrate very rapidly. You've got to have some type of head covering on. It's pretty much mandatory. All right, let's move on. Okay, we talked about Israel becoming a nation in 1948. We say the 14th of May, 15th of May. The reason we say 14th, 15th of May is because it happened at midnight. David Ben-Gurion makes the proclamation that Israel is once again a nation. It has been reborn. And of course, now Hebrew becomes the national language of the people. You see, there have been the Hebrew never completely died. It wasn't always spoken on the streets, but we kept Hebrew alive in the synagogues. The Orthodox Jews were very hard-headed, shall I say. We said that whenever the Torah would be read, it was to be read in Hebrew. If you wanted to read it in whatever language you lived in, of that nation, that's okay. But first you read it in Hebrew. When the prayers were said in Hebrew first. Then you could say it in whatever language you wanted to. When the Reform Jews came around, the Reform Jews said, "We don't want to speak Hebrew. We live here in America. Nobody speaks Hebrew in America. Let's just do everything in English." The Orthodox Jews said, "I don't think so. You do it in Hebrew. Then if you want to do it in English, that's good. But you do it in Hebrew first." It's just very dogmatic. But if we had not been so dogmatic, how would Hebrew have come back? Today you can take a child that is in grade school. Take him to the Israeli Museum, where they have the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls that were written over 2,000 years ago. The school-aged child can read it and understand it because the Hebrew has not changed. 80% of the Hebrew spoken today is biblical Hebrew. The other 20%, well, these are new words. But do you know what the Hebrew word for radio is? Radio. The Hebrew word for a taxi? Taxi. For chocolate? Chocolat. Television? Televisia. Obviously, these are not biblical names. These had to be adopted. But 80% of modern Hebrew is actually biblical Hebrew. All right, let's move on. We have a lot to cover. Here you have what we call the different terrorist movements. Real quick here. I'm not going to belabor, but I do want to make you aware of these groups. Because these groups, you hear about them, but I dare say that most people know very little about them. Number one, let's talk about Hamas. H-A-M-A-S. Hamas. It is the Islamic Resistance Movement. It was started back in 1987. The leaders of it, or the founders, was Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. It started in the West Bank in Gaza. Its leaders were also in Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. Their ideology is the same as that of the Muslim Brotherhood. They opposed the PLO. They said that Israel will exist until Islam will obliterate it. Their motto is that there is no solution for the Palestinian question except for jihad. By the way, you have Hamas here. You've had Hamas here now for 20 years. Right now, we know of 35 terrorist camps in the United States. We have Hamas in Dallas. You have Hamas in Fayetteville. You have Hamas in Little Rock. You also have what we call Hezbollah, and we'll talk about those in a moment. Anybody hear of a group called CAIR? C-A-I-R. Commission for the American Islamic Relations. Called CARE. Commission of American Islamic Relations. They are Hamas. Earlier this year, we had a trial in Dallas called the Holy Land Foundation. We had our first trial last year. Last year we picked up 5 men on 190 counts of terrorism against the United States. That trial ended in a mistrial. The night before the final judgment was given, somebody got to the jurors, and they changed their plea. We then caught another 7 men, and we were able to convict them on 12 counts of terrorism against the United States. They were funded by Sharia financing. Anybody hear of Sharia financing? Yes, no. My friends, you need to become familiar with Sharia finance. Sharia financing is growing rapidly in the United States. Sharia financing goes according to Sharia law. Sharia law is the Muslim Islamic law. That means that in order for banks that are Sharia compliant in order for them to become Sharia compliant, they have to have a Sharia expert on their board. There's only 100 Sharia experts in the world right now. A lot of these are sheikhs. A certain percentage of the profits of that Sharia compliant bank goes to Muslim charities. 27 of those Muslim charities so far in the United States have been found to be terrorist organizations. The Holy Land Foundation was one of those. What are some of the banks that are Sharia compliant? AIG, Citibank, Wachovia, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, HSBC, as well as a bunch of other banks. We're seeing it growing very rapidly. That means that any investments that are done by the bank must follow Islamic law. If you notice, a lot of those banks that we just mentioned were banks that were bailed out, including AIG. Their links, many of them are linked to Hamas. Sharia, Sharia. If you want to know more about it, you can go to a website called shariafinancewatch.org. All one word, shariafinancewatch.org. Let's talk real quick about Hezbollah. Hezbollah was created back in 1982. Its founder was the Iranian revolutionary. The guards, the spiritual father, was Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadallah. Its location, southern Lebanon, and it was established by Iran. Ideology, Shia Islamic fundamentalist terrorist organization, Lebanese political party, goes out to establish Islamic State across the Arab world to eliminate Israel and fight Western imperialism. If you wonder why the United States have not done a whole lot to stop Iran with the nuclear, its nuclear facilities, if you remember right, the president of Iran threatened the United States and said, if you do anything against our nuclear facilities, we will activate Hezbollah in your country. Again, you have had Hezbollah here for 20 years. These two groups, what are they known for? Suicide bombings. Hamas is the one that's very popular with strapping the bombs even on children. So the Iranian president said, if you do anything to try to stop us, we will activate Hezbollah in your country. Like I said, they've been here for 20 years. The Jewish community, we have been tracking what they're doing. And so we keep a good eye on what is happening here. This is one of the reasons that you hear us speaking out. By the way, the Holy Land Foundation, who broke it, who exposed it, some of our Israeli operatives here in America. Yes. Well, believe me, it's to our benefit as well. Another group that is very popular even here in the United States is the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, called PIJ. Again, it was located in the West Bank and Gaza, sponsored by Iran and Syria. And of course, Syria gets a lot of its weaponry from Russia, as well as Iran gets a lot from Russia. Questions, comments, rebuttals? Yes. I'm so glad you asked. I also work with another organization called Act for America, actforamerica.org. It stands for the American Congress of Truth. It was started by a woman by the name of Brigitte Gabrielle. Brigitte Gabrielle grew up in Lebanon. She was a Lebanese Christian. She grew up in Lebanon in the 1970s. And for those of you history people, if you remember what Lebanon was in the early 70s, Lebanon in the early 1970s was the only Christian nation in the Middle East. It was the New York of the Middle East. It was very materialistic. It was Beirut, especially, was the New York of the area. They had the theaters. They had everything that we have here in America. And what they wanted, they had an open door policy, opened its borders to everybody. They wanted the rest of the Middle East to see the benefits of Western Christianity. And so they left their borders open. Remember those 630 refugees? Many of them came into Lebanon. When they did, they joined with Hezbollah. In the early 1970s, Hezbollah took over the country. It took 7%. They only had to have 7% of the entire population to take over. Brigitte Gabrielle was there. She was a young girl. She lived for 7 years in a bomb shelter because her home had been bombed multiple times by Hezbollah. You need to read her book. She went from there to Israel, found out that a lot of things that she had been taught about the Jews were lies. Remember I said that she was a Lebanese Christian. Even though she was a Lebanese Christian, she had been taught that all the problems were because of the Jews and because of the Israelis. In her book, she talks about how it was the Israelis that really saved her life. In the life of her family. And she came to realize that what she had been told by all the people were lies. While she was in Jerusalem, she met an American. They got married. She went through the citizenship process, became a citizen of the United States. Now her campaign is to warn you of what is going on. You see, you haven't had to deal with these people before. We've had to deal with them for thousands of years. We know their agenda. We know what they want to do. And so this organization, Act for America, will send you emails. You can sign up for it. It's free. You can sign up on their email deal. They will send you out emails of letting you know what is going on and what you can do. For example, how many of you are familiar with Tyson Chicken? You remember what Tyson Chicken did last year? Anybody familiar with it? Tyson Chicken last year decided to drop some of the American holidays and replace it with Islamic holidays. You remember? Act of America caught wind of it. We sent letters out to all of our constituents. We put pressure on them. You see, the reason they did that is because of the 1,200 employees they had. 700 of the 1,200 employees were Somalians, Muslims from Somalia. We put pressure on them and they stopped it and reversed it. How many of you are familiar with the John Doe bill? Anybody? You should be. The John Doe bill is the bill that protects you as American citizens so that if you see suspicious activity, that you are to notify the authorities, and it protects you from being sued. Remember when the six imams were kicked off the airlines last year? Remember that? Last year there were six imams that were kicked off of an airline because of some suspicious activity by them. They sued the airlines. Then they went after all the passengers that turned them in. But the John Doe bill protected the U.S. citizens, and they could not sue the citizens. So they went after the John Doe bill to have it removed from Homeland Security. Act for America found out about it. We emailed all of our constituents, told the constituents to email and call their congressmen, senators, representatives, and to express to them that we wanted the John Doe bill kept in Homeland Security. We did. You came that close to losing it. So these are things that you can do. You can do. Yes, sir. Very much so. Very much so. By the way, the Treasury Department is very, very much behind Sharia financing. They're pushing it because they see that there's 1.2 billion Muslims and they think that they're going to get all their business. We're selling our freedom because of the love of money. Wake up. Wake up. Who knows who the Maccabees were? Remember back in the 2nd century B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes came and desecrated the temple in Jerusalem, sacrificed a pig. He then sent soldiers to all the country to have the Jews bow down and to worship this image and to pay their allegiance until they came to a town called Moadim. And there was a priestly family that said, we're not doing it. And they stood up to them. And yes, it caused a battle. Within 3 years, we regained Jerusalem. We saved our country. Question. And this is a rhetorical question. What would have happened if the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, I've been more concerned about being politically correct than standing up for what is right. There would have been no Israel. We had a foreign power that came into our land and told us who we were going to worship, to change our law, but to have us do according to their laws. As hard-headed Jews, we said, not doing it. What's the message? In many ways, we found ourselves in the same situation today. Yes. All the above. Nothing. Nothing. Actually, the imams have said that by the year 2050, their plan was to have control of America by the year 2050. However, in January, everything changed, and they upped the timetable to 2020. Things are moving extremely rapidly. We're seeing many changes take place. What am I saying to do? Well, here's where you have to make a decision. Here we have to decide whether we're going to be politically correct or we're going to stand up and do what is right. There's a lot of things that as Americans we can do legally. One of them is to stand up for our rights. This last presidential election, only 25% of Christians voted. 25% of Christians voted in this election. We have rights that we can exercise. We have the right to be able to voice our concerns. We need to remember that our elected officials are supposed to work for us, not us work for them. Well, it's because a lot of them don't hear from the American public. A lot of them don't hear from the American public. But we can change things. I don't think that we're at a point that we can't change. Yet. We're rapidly moving that direction. But we're still at a point where we can make a change. And part of that is standing up. I'll give you a good example. In Dearborn, Michigan, you will find that the Muslims have come in and they have built the mosques, the minarets, and they have call 5 times a day that's broadcast. Some of the people in the area complained about it. In fact, a few of them did take them to court and said that it violated the noise ordinance. Muslims won. Why? Because they fought. They said it was their religious right to be able to broadcast prayer 5 times a day. However, the churches cannot ring a church bell. The churches were silent. They did not get involved. What happened when prayer was removed from school? Well, that's not completely true. I mean, even with ACT, ACT is trying to get people to do things. Well, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here. And so, yeah, you can go to the website, actforamerica.org. I think I'll have to look. I might have a few left. But any other questions, comments? ACT will tell you just what all you can do. It'll let you know what's going on. And a lot of times much quicker than what you will hear in other places. Actually, I find out what's happening in America a lot of times faster from Israeli sources than I do from American sources. A lot of times I can find out what's happening in America as much as 9 hours before the American media talks about it from Israeli sources. Huh? Right. How much did you hear about the Holy Land Foundation trial? Do you know in Dallas, we had the Holy Land Foundation trial in Dallas. You know how many times it was mentioned during the trial? None. It was never mentioned on radio. It was never mentioned on television. The Dallas Morning News, when the verdict was given, had a little small paragraph about it on their web page. But it did not appear on the media, because the media right now is afraid to do things. Right. We won't be politically correct. Okay, let's just take a real quick scan here. How many of you actually read a newspaper? You read the internet? There's a lot of things that are not talked about. Now, if you want some documentation on those figures that I gave you, send me an email at dalecohen@hotmail.com, and I'll be more than happy to send you the link to one of the Israeli newspapers that gives you a lot of the information. One of the places that you can go to find some news is a place called kolisrael.com. That's kolisrael.com. It means a voice of Israel. It is an Israeli newspaper group. When you pop it up on your screen, it'll pop up this blue screen with all these different windows. There's probably about 50 different newspapers that you can read from. Some of these are Jordanian, Arab, but they have several of the Israelis. The one that you want is called Arut Sheva, and I'll spell that for you. A-R-U-T-Z. And then the numeral 7. Or A-R-U-T-Z, and then the numeral 7. Sometimes you'll hear it called Arut Sheva, and that would be A-R-U-T-Z, new word, S-H-E-V-A. Sheva means 7. Arut 7, Arut Sheva. And it will give you a lot of information again. It is an Israeli newspaper, so it comes out of Israel. But again, I can find out a lot of things that's happening in the U.S. quicker. Yeah. Jerusalem Post is good. Ynet is another Israeli deal. Haaretz is another one. But you can find all those links on the Kol Israel location. Well, I'll let you know what is going on. And with the Arut Sheva, they have a place, has its own search engine, so you can type in to it and you can find all their archives on their different articles on that particular deal. So, like, you know, you can look up General Keith Dayton and find the different articles that talk about what General Dayton is doing as far as training the Palestinian Authority. So, any other questions, comments, rebuttals? Yes, sir. Now that Bibi is in office, Bibi is not as amenable to doing a lot of that. The roadmap to peace, they actually wanted to do that back this time last year because they wanted to have it done before President Bush left office. Condoleezza Rice was one of the ones that was really, really pushing it. Now Clinton is strongly pushing it. There's also a woman by the name of Susan Power, which is on Obama's staff. She, too, is really, really pushing it because she says that Israel, the creation of Israel, was a mistake. And so she wants to see. Her idea is that America should stop supporting Israel at all, give no aid to Israel, but give all that aid to the Arabs. By the way, back in, what was it, in 04, I think it was 30 August 04, United States built a air base in Israel. It was built by the Arabs. No Israelis were allowed. It was America's way of showing the Arabs the benefits of working with America. About 10 minutes from Tel Aviv. Those of you who would like a report on that, I'll again send me an email requesting that, and I'll give you the link where you can get more information on that. Any other questions, rebuttals, comments? Yes, sir. The insults. Not really. No, not in the White House, no. No. Real quick, I want to end this on a positive note, and then we'll start. I want to show you a little bit of what Israel has contributed to the rest of the world. And even though Israel is very small, it has some very big ideas. Israel has the world's highest per capita rate of university degrees. Israel has the world's highest ratio of scientists and technicians in the workforce, with 135 per 1,000 citizens, compared to the United States, who has 85 to 1,000. Israel has the world's second highest per capita output of new books annually. Israelis like to read. Israel produces more scientific papers per capita than any other nation in the world. Let's look at some of the how they're at the forefront of high tech. The world's Silicon Valley and a global source of innovation, Israel has the highest concentration of high-tech companies in the world, apart from Silicon Valley itself. Israel has become the world's fourth largest high-tech economy in the 1990s. Now it's increased that as well. Israel has the third largest number of NASDAQ companies in the world. United States and Canada is first and second. Microsoft and Intel built their only non-U.S. R&D facilities in Israel. Over 50 of the international giants also established R&D, research and development facilities in Israel. By the way, how many of you use cell phones? Thank you. You're using an Israeli invention. The Israelis were the first ones to come out with cell phones. By the way, how many of you use IM, instant messaging? Thank you. You're using an Israeli invention. The Israelis were the first ones to do IM, instant messaging. A lot of your computer components that you use come from Israel. Not the programs, but the computer components are Israeli. By the way, the Israelis developed the Pentium 4 processors. There was an Israeli, as well as the Centrino processing for laptops. Voicemail technology is Israeli. Electro-optic chips and nanotechnology. By the way, you know, there's been a lot of controversy over stem cell, right? Israelis do stem cells. But you know what? Where they get them from? Anybody know? From the disposed umbilical cords. That way they don't sacrifice human life for stem cells. They said the umbilical cord is going to be thrown away anyway, yes? So, let's make use of it and take stem cells from it. So this just kind of give you a little bit of an idea. There's much, much more. I wish we had a couple more days to share with you some more of the things that are going on. But this will give you an idea. God said that Israel would be a blessing to all the nations. And Israel has been a blessing to all the nations. Not only biblically, for this is where Messiah came from, but even technologically, through agriculture, and through many other areas. Israel has continued to be a blessing to the world. Now Israel needs you to help stand up. Just remember this. Israel is the little Satan. America is called the great. Don't think that what happening in Israel will not happen here. This is why Israel is standing up and they're saying, if we don't stop it, it will happen here. Okay. You want me to close? All right. Won't you stand with me, please? Avinu Malchinu, our Father and our King. Lord, we thank you for this time that we've had as a body of believers to come and to learn about you, to learn about the nation of Israel. And we pray that you continue to keep your hand on this nation. I also pray that you keep your hand on the nation of Israel. I pray for its defenders, those who stand up, who give their life to defend the country, as well as the defenders of America, those who give their life to defend our land here. Give us strength, give us encouragement, but give us chutzpah, boldness, to be able to stand up for what we believe in. Not to be afraid to speak out. Give us the courage to stand before not only you, but to stand before all nations, before all people, that others will look at this nation and they'll see the great things that God has done in our land. Just as other nations look at Israel and they see what a mighty God we serve. What a mighty God who has performed miracles to protect its land. Be with us tonight. Keep us safe. open up our hearts, our minds, and our ears. And Father, I pray that the words that we've spoke today will find a